Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blasingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc., all rights reserved.
Hi, folks. Jim Blasingame here. You probably think of IBM as a world leader in computers and software, but what you might not know is that they also offer outstanding technology services for your small business. For example, did you know that IBM made house calls? That's right. They will install your new IBM PC systems there in your small business for as little as $100. Do you know how much trouble it can be to move your information and programs from an old computer to a new one? Well, IBM's data migration services eliminate that hassle. IBM services are designed to help small business owners focus on what they do best by handling certain tasks for us, which can save time and give us a lot less to worry about. To find the long list of valuable IBM services, go to www.ibm.com/smallbusiness and click on the services link on the left. I think you'll be impressed. That's www.ibm.com/smallbusiness and click on services. Thanks, IBM, for giving us a better ownership experience.
He inspires small business.
We can teach these barbarians a lesson in Western methods and efficiency that will put them to shame.
He tells it like it is.
I realize how difficult it's going to be in this godforsaken place where you can't find what you need. There's the challenge.
He's Jim Blasingame, the Small Business Advocate.
With all due respect, sir, I believe this is going to be our finest hour.
We're back. It's 34 after. 800-531-3815, toll-free coast-to-coast, 800-531-3815. Knight Kiplinger is our guest. Knight is the editor-in-chief of the Kiplinger editors, all of their publications, the four letters, the Kiplinger Personal Finance Magazine, their website. He's the grandson of the founder of Kiplinger, which, as you know, is the premier business forecasting publication in the world. He's the author of World Boom Ahead, which is a book that I think is still very, very valid, and we're actually going to reference it, some things from it today. Knight, welcome back to the show.
Nice to be with you, Jim.
It's good to have you back, as always, and congratulations on your 80th year for Kiplinger.
Well, it's no mean feat to survive as a small, closely held business for 80 years in America. As many of your listeners know, they're struggling just to establish a business and keep it going for 10 or 15 years. But, you know, our estate tax laws conspire against the longevity of closely held businesses. Mm-hmm. Our company has survived by having significant employee ownership. We have an ESOP that holds about 22% of the stock of our company, which
That's
gives
great.
All of our employees a stake in its survival. So we're very honored to have made it this long.
Well, you've done it, obviously done it the right way. Knight, let's begin by our discussion by talking about the thing that's on everybody's minds these days. Walk us through what you think is going to happen regarding Iraq over the next 2 weeks, which I believe are going to be two very pivotal weeks.
Well, you're right, Jim. There are a variety of things that could happen to derail a military deposing of Saddam Hussein. For example, an 11th-hour brokered exile for Saddam, or an 11th-hour coup, or an 11th-hour conversion to the path of righteousness, us on his part, the decision after a decade of flouting UN resolutions that he's suddenly going to conform to them. I think that all of those possibilities are unlikely. An exile or a coup would have to involve the entire Ba'athist leadership of his regime, not just himself personally, and I don't see that happening. Even if there were an authentic coup of Saddam's opponents, it's probably likely that the U.S. and Britain would go in anyway to be a stabilizing force to assist a new representative government in getting established. Nobody wants war, but at this point it looks as if it's the only alternative to leaving a very bad and dangerous man in that position of authority for years to come.
Well, Knight, I agree with you. And, you know, the first of the year, I predicted in my 2003 predictions, I predicted that there would actually not be a war with Iraq this year. And I'm still not varying from that prediction very much. I think that I still hold out the belief that one of your first two predictions might happen. I think that Saddam will hold on until he absolutely is certain that he can't hold on any longer. I don't think he has a death wish. I think he wants to continue to contribute to to terror around the world, and the only way he can do that is to live to fight another day, and that would be to run away. And I really think he will do that instead of causing us to have to go in and bomb them. But the thing is, though, is that I agree with you. When people say, well, what are we going to do with all those troops? Well, those troops don't have to be there to invade. They could be there just to stabilize.
Well, that would be a very good scenario. If that came to pass, of course, it would be a great triumph for the Bush foreign policy, because nothing short of the credibility of going to war would have accomplished the scenario that you were describing, a mm-hmm. peaceful deposing of Saddam Hussein.
Right. Which could have already happened had we not had so much resistance from people like the French and the Germans.
Well, that's quite true. If we have a regime change in Iraq without war, it'll be interesting to hear what the French and Germans say. Will mm-hmm. they credit the firmness and the resolve of the U.S. government with pulling off this miraculous regime change? I doubt it. That would, in fact, be where credit lies. I tend to still feel that is a long shot and that a military engagement is still likely. But I like your scenario better. I hope it comes to pass.
Well, of course, I was writing that, you know, 2.5 months ago. So, I'm trying to stick to that, to be hopeful for that. But it's looking less and less likely that's going to happen. Knight, standby. Folks, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I'm going to ask Knight, why is there so much anti-Americanism in the world? And why is there actually anti-Americanism in America? 20 till. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Back at 17 till. Let me remind you, coming up in the show straight ahead, Ken Lebo is going to talk to us about some incredible things to do on the internet. Then after that, Rosalind Glickman is going to help us optimize our thinking. Right now, we're visiting with our good friend Knight Kiplinger, editor-in-chief of the Kiplinger Editors. And folks, don't forget to check out their website. You've heard me speak of it many times before, kiplinger.com. You can go there and subscribe to all the different publications. And you guys still got that 30-day free trial, don't you, Knight?
We sure do. And a lot of people are reading our newsletters online and saving waiting for the mail each week.
Yeah, and that's good for the publishing companies, too. It always helps to take advantage of that technology and helps you guys maximize your efficiencies there, too. Knight, why is there so much anti-Americanism around the world? It seems that there is.
Certainly seems to be. There are people who seem to resent a unilateralism on the part of the United States, America deciding what's in the best interest for itself and the world and proceeding, not always with as much cooperation with other nations. Remember that there is in human relations everywhere a tendency to resent powerful organizations or individuals upon whom you are dependent. You resent that dependency.
Mm-hmm.
And in the 20th century, the United States came to the assistance of Europe on a number of occasions to pull its fat out of the fire, first in World War I, secondly when Hitler rolled across Europe in 1939. Mm-hmm. It took us a long time to enter that war, 2 full years, but we did so. And, of course, for a half century, America and NATO's strength contained the threat of Soviet expansionism in Europe. But there are a lot of young Europeans who don't know that history. They never lived under fascism. They take for granted their freedom, and they're not aware of the crucial role that the United States has played in the security of Europe.
Isn't that amazing?
For almost 100 years. So they resent the United States. At the same time, of course, they envy the United States and want to emulate much of our system. Some of the same foreign students who are carrying placards against the United States want very much to come here and study because they know that our higher education and our entrepreneurial system is the model of emulation for everybody in the world. So it's a love-hate relationship. They embrace our popular culture. They want to replicate our system in their country, but at the same time they resent our power and resent how dependent their nations are on America's prosperity.
So it's a hypocritical anti-Americanism, isn't it?
It is. It may be unconsciously hypocritical.
Mm-hmm.
There was a news report this morning on the Marketplace program on public radio about South Korean students who are carrying Hate America placards, and in the next breath they say, I'm looking forward to coming to California to study engineering.
You know, Knight, I saw an interview of a young lady, a young North South Korean lady, who was anxious to get American troops out of their country, and somebody asked her, they said, aren't you worried about North Korea, invading South Korea? And she said, oh, no, we're not worried about that.
And, of course, South Korea is virtually the creation of America's economic and technological and military support for the last half century. 50 years ago, South Korea had as low a standard of living as any tiny nation of Africa or Central America. Today, it's one of the most advanced nations on Earth.
Almost 100% of broadband connectivity.
That's right. And South Korea owes its prosperity to America's military and economic support for the half century. They know that. The smart ones know it. The young people are feisty and full of beans. They don't think they need a close tie to the United States. They don't fear North Korea, which is very short-sighted of them. And this is the result you see.
Yeah. Knight, what about inside of America? There seems to be a lot. There seems to be people who just want to blame America first, and that really troubles me.
You're right, Jim. I see this. I've got a couple of kids in college, and many of their friends take this point of view as well. They think that we are an evil power in the world. As they grow up and mature and learn more about the U.S. economy and how the United States has been a positive force for democracy and open markets around the world, I think that they will mature and grow up. But they're under the influence, in many cases, of left-wing college professors who have made a career of hating the nation of their residency, and it's not surprising, but they'll learn in time, I think.
Well, also, there seems to be a few of those people in Congress as well.
there are indeed.
McDermott went over to Iraq and basically lambasted the president on Iraqi soil. I don't understand that.
No, foreign policy stops at the water's edge traditionally, and there is obviously room for well-meaning questioning and debate. That's what our society is built upon. But I think at some point you have to close ranks and make the best of your president's policy.
Mm-hmm. Just before we go to a break on this issue, is the UN irrelevant now? Is it official now? It's irrelevant?
It is. It's not a significant force for improvement in the world and really hasn't been. It's sort of a debating society. It's also quite a prominent forum for anti-Americanism. So
mm-hmm.
The United States has decided that we're going to go with or without their support, and in some cases that's appropriate.
Well, and the thing is maybe one of the benefits of the president's attitude is to make this farce official. I mean, the fact that I should say that you at the UN is a farce and that it is not relevant, and to make that fact official. And I think that's what will happen. I think that's another reason why the next 2 weeks are going to be very pivotal in the history of the Earth. Actually,
that is really true. And the president, in a sense, is being the biggest supporter of the United Nations because he is forcing it to confront its own weaknesses
mm-hmm.
and enforce resolutions that they have been throwing out for a decade but never enforcing. And the president said it's time to stand up for your own pride.
They're going to have to lay their cards down. He's going to be shining some sunlight on that situation up there, and I think that'll go down as one of the important things of his career. Of his administration. Stand by, Knight. We're going to take a quick break. Folks, when we come back, I'm going to ask Knight, what do you think the economy is going to do the rest of the year? And we're going to talk about the president's tax proposals. Which of the president's proposals is going to get through? Stand by. 10 till. Stay with us. We're back. 7 till. Knight Kiplinger is our guest. He's editor-in-chief of the Kiplinger Editors, also Kiplinger Personal Finance Magazine, and all the four Kiplinger letters that are published, one weekly, the Kiplinger letter every week, and the other three, I should say, biweekly letters, the California letter, the tax letter, and the agriculture letter, and all under the outstanding direction of Knight Kiplinger. Knight, talk to us about, well, first up, I think you'd agree with me that the economy is is sort of bound up in the anticipation of what's going on, what's going to be happening in the next couple of weeks in Iraq. A lot of stuff's been put on hold. We got some bad unemployment news last month. It seems like everything's on hold. Not everything, but a lot, too much is on hold. When we resolve this thing, we go to war, we take Saddam out, whatever happens over the next 30 or 60 to 60 days or so, is the economy going to rebound?
I think it's going to rebound. It is in a state of what I call suspended animation right now. At the Kiplinger Letter, we talked to a lot of business people around the country who say that they have expansion plans and modernization plans, new equipment purchase plans that are on hold. And as soon as there's some resolution to this geopolitical situation, they want to proceed with those plans. At the same time, we're seeing a rather brutal reduction of capacity, overcapacity, weak competitors failing. This will give the surviving companies firmer profits and some pricing power in the marketplace that they've been lacking. And I think it all points to an uptick of growth later this year.
Do you think that Well, it seems that many, many companies out there, and certainly most of the investment companies, are literally flush with cash. There's a lot of cash out there waiting to go somewhere. Do you think that will contribute to a rebounding of the economy?
I think it will. I think the stock market is near a low. Nobody can predict a low, but it certainly looks as if it's much better priced than it was a year or so ago, and I think that money will find its way back into the market. A strengthening economy over the next year or two will mean gradually rising interest rates, which will be ominous for bondholders, and I think we'll see some of that money flowing out of bonds and cash and back into the stock market once again later this year.
Not in your 1998 book, World Boom Ahead, which, by the way, folks, I'm assuming is still available?
It is still available, I think, on Amazon and BN.com. They have some copies. A lot of people are hiding away their forecast books of 3 or 4 years ago, but mine is a long-range book, and I think the main themes are still quite valid.
Well, it is, and mine's dog-eared within an inch of its life. I use it all the time. At night, you predicted in your book, War Boom Ahead, that consumers and businesses were going to enjoy prosperity over the next two decades. Do you still feel that way?
I still do. I think that trade barriers are generally declining around the world, creating great export markets for the United States. Productivity is rising very strong in the United States, and productivity gains underlie all gains in living standards for every worker. So I think that's still on track. It doesn't move in a straight line. There are setbacks along the way, and there will certainly be many in our future. But I think the general trend is towards rising living standards, not just in the U.S., but globally.
Well, that's good to hear. I'm glad to know that you're still optimistic. Knight, we got about a minute and a half. Talk to us about the president's tax proposal. Which part of his proposal will make it on the other side?
Well, the president is going to get barely half a loaf of what he is seeking. He wants to accelerate all the marginal rate cuts from the 01 bill. I think Congress will accelerate only the rate cuts for low and moderate income taxpayers, not for upper income taxpayers. They're not going to make the abolition of the estate tax permanent. No way that's going to happen. They're not going to abolish all taxation of dividend income, perhaps just a modest dividend exclusion of $3,000 or so. They're going to do a little fixing of the so-called marriage penalty for upper-income couples who marry and have a higher tax bill by combining their incomes. Will they fix the alternative minimum tax? Probably not in this bill. For small business, I think they're going to raise that annual expensing of equipment costs from the current $25,000 to a much higher level, which will be great for small business.
You think it'll go to $75,000? That's what the president...
They might go all the way up there, which will stimulate equipment sales to small businesses this year.
Mm-hmm.
So, and, you know, that per-child tax credit of $600, that's going to be raised to $1,000 per child. Very powerful tax relief for moderate-income families with several small children.
Absolutely. Knight, thank you so much for being here today. Good job. We appreciate your time very much, and hope you'll come back again real soon.
I hope I can, Jim.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Matt Kiplinger, ladies and gentlemen. He'll be back another day. He's the author of War Boom Ahead. You can still find that wherever books are sold, and, of course, don't forget Kiplinger.com. I got to go for this hour. Before I do, I want to thank my heroes, small business owners, because without your courage, hard work, and devotion to your dreams, America would not be the greatest entrepreneurial country in the world. And remember, when opportunity knocks, it doesn't know you've had a bad day. Greet it with a smile. This is Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate, and this program is for you.
I'll be right back.
Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blasingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc., intended for the private use of our audience. Except as otherwise provided by copyright law, all other copying, redistribution, or publication without prior written consent is prohibited. All rights reserved.